And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN Audio, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
Once again, I'm going to reach back into the vault for one of my favorite Axe Files conversations, this one with Tom Hanks, the remarkable actor, but also just an incredibly interesting guy. Here in this conversation, he talked about his upbringing, which was not what you'd expect from the wholesome, all-American guy. Had a lot of challenges that he worked through and ultimately led him to find community in theater. We also talked history, about which he is very, very fluent, including the history of World War II. And just a side note, Tom and his wife Rita Wilson were two of the early celebrities to report COVID-19. They've since recovered from it, and we wish them the best. I hope you enjoy this conversation with Tom Hanks, recorded in 2017. Tom Hanks, great to be with you. What's interesting to me is, how do you become Tom Hanks? How does Tom Hanks become Tom Hanks? Because I did a little reading about your life. I mean, people look at you, you're warm, you're garrulous, you're kind of an American icon, and they say, well, he must have grown up with Ward and June Cleaver. I mean, he must be like with Wally and the Beaver. Your childhood wasn't like that.
No, my parents, the joke is they pioneered the marriage dissolution laws for the state of California, you know. It's my dad, Janet Amos, and Zsa Zsa Gabor all had a lot of divorces between the between them. But I can't. It's funny. Well, I have three siblings. I'm the third kid of four, and we all have different takes on the environment that we grew up in. And mine was is that other than it being confusing sometimes, and otherwise it being having a parents who weren't anxious to tell us what was going on in the world, I kind of thought it was an adventure. I thought we moved. I had ten different homes by the time I was 10 years old, and I thought
that is confusing.
Yeah, but I thought it was kind of cool. I lived in I had a bunch of step siblings. We lived in apartments. We lived almost like on quasi farms. We lived in the outskirts of town. We lived in the middle of towns.
Different schools.
I went to one kindergarten, a first grade, then a second grade, and a third, then a fourth, third, fourth, fifth. But I wasn't intimidated. I guess a type A garrulous personality, as you say. I was able to size up what was going on pretty quick, and some degree of, a good sense of humor and some degree of confidence and a great amount of adopted independence, I think. If I was going to say there was a problem there, I traveled emotionally light, mm-hmm. meaning I didn't take a lot of the burdens of that confusion along with me.
The older kids maybe did a little more.
Well, I think just because they were older and they had experienced more of it. But by the by the time I was 10, I thought it was kind of cool to have lived in as many different places that I lived in. And then it's funny. I lived in one house until I was 14, so 10 to 14. And that was the longest I had lived anywhere, 4 years in one place. And then we started moving again every year.
I read somewhere you described yourself in school as a nerd, a spaz, painfully shy.
Well, I was...
Those aren't words that people associate with
that's
you.
That's what I said.
Yeah.
I was at combat, I think, with the reality of the home environment. I was, other than this brief period of time when we lived, my dad was not married, and it was just of the four of us, my dad, my older brother, and my older sister.
Your dad was a cook. Right?
He was in the restaurant business. Cook. Yeah, he was a chef, cook, ran the place a lot of times. Outside for 2.5 years where we sort of lived alone, I was not necessarily anxious to get home. Because there was an unspoken tension in the house. There was always something that was not being said, like how long we're going to live there, or how good dad and his wife are getting along. So I think the combat I had was a liveliness and a distraction that was built on, you know, hanging out with other people and, you know, staying busy and sort of like being in the entertainment business without realizing I was in the entertainment business.
Well, when did you realize that you wanted to entertain? When did the acting bug?
I was always a guy who shouted out wisecracks during the slideshow at school. But when I was in high school and had that, well, what are you going to do? What do you take in high school? Biology, government, world history. What are you going to do? I ran the track team for a while with absolutely no enthusiasm whatsoever. But then when a friend of mine was in the school play, and I saw him do this, and I just said, what's this racket? You're telling me we could come and do this here? I thought it was only for Parks Department stuff, or maybe, you know, yeah. in the church group you might put on, you know, skits and stuff like that. And when I realized it was when I found out, there was a classroom that had a stage in it, and you could take more than one class, and it wasn't babysitting. We had I've spoken about my teacher there, a guy named Raleigh Farnsworth, who was a man of the theater, and that's what we did. So discovering that was, well, this was just more fun than fun is. Beats the hell out of every other class I'm taking there. It was actually kind of a lot like a class in which the same skills were required of it than was to hang around at lunchtime and, you know, and try to entertain the girls.
And what about it particularly? What about acting? I mean, it seems to me, I mean, I admire, you're the best of the best, but anyone who can inhabit a character and become someone else.
Well, I was just doing purely on instinct, but the instinct was to throw myself into it totally. When I was in a play or when I was performing it took up every moment of my day and every brain cell. I was always thinking about what I was going to do or how between learning the lines and the excitement of just being there and getting ready to go on. I think there are people who are actors and there are people who are not, never will be. I just am one of those that was not self-conscious about it. It was really sort of like champing at the bit in order to go be a part of something.
What about the reaction to it? There must have been some thrill associated with being entertaining people.
Well, there was just the excitement of knowing that anybody had shown up specifically to watch what you are in. And that division between the proscenium, the audience, was very powerful, whether they liked you or not. I mean, if they laugh, you know, I was in like South Pacific or something like that. That was really exciting. But I also had the same exact thrill of when I was a stage manager of the shows, because we were a part of this magic thing that was hidden from them. But you could hear them. You could feel the heat of an audience. You could actually feel the focus of their eyeballs on you. And if they started reacting in a way to something that you were doing, well, that's just, David, that's crack cocaine. It's crack cocaine.
Did you, and you must have found a community then with people who you were acting with, working with, crews, and
I
so
would
on.
Say I found it. I found the tribe that I think every person needs to belong to, that every person needs to seek out. There were people at church that were great. There were people that were, you know, populated the individual classes. There were people that I got along with. But I felt as though I had, you know, a secret tattoo or, you know, the shared same DNA with the people that were in the drama department. And when I went off to college, I didn't realize that even there I was playing, I thought there was some other test or rules. I didn't realize that the theater or dramatics was a discipline that you could pursue. I thought it was just something you instinctively did, you know, to hang out with funny people and have a gas. And after, you know, 3 years of doing that, I realized, I can major in this. And I might be able to get a job as a follow spot operator or as a stage carpenter or as a stage manager.
And that's kind of how you started out, right? When you were in Ohio, you were really crew.
That we were hired in order to change the sets over. And we were, those of us who were paid made about 48 bucks a week. Those of us who were not paid, thank you very much, did it for the professional experience, because it was professional actors and we were in rep, rotating rep. And we were giving parts, small parts, and you know, you carried a spear, or I played Reynaldo in Hamlet, which is a part that's always cut for good reasons. But in the course of that, you know, there were some people who were given more responsibilities. And between the company saving money by paying an intern 50 bucks a week as opposed to paying an equity actor, you know, $250 a week, that was the difference between having the experience and not. And I did that. I only did that
for... You already were married. You had a kid at that point, right?
I was not married, but yeah. My son had been born, for the 3 years, by the time we got married, he was two, and I had made the move. I had a card in my wallet that said I was a professional actor. And the great friends I had, other members of the tribe, said, "You don't go back to Sacramento, California. You go to New York." "Well, shouldn't I go to Minneapolis?" "No." "Shouldn't I go to Kansas?" "No." "Should I go to Chicago?" "No one's here from Chicago. You come to New York." And that's what I did. And I had a kid. And we got married when I was there. And it was horrifying and scary. But you make your peace with that kind of... New York was a very different place in 1977, 78.
Yeah.
You make your peace with that.
That was in Son of Sam times there.
We had that. Yeah. It was kind of like walking into Scorsese's Taxi Drivers is what it was. But I viewed it as you know, I think as you're figuring out this stuff, you have these vibrant... You know, you were talking about, you know, when you were... doing, you know, local elections. Mm-hmm. You can't imagine doing anything else. And,
right.
And the combat, the battle comes in the daily seeking of purchase, you know. There were days you woke up, you had nothing to do. Nothing. There were no auditions. Maybe you could get together.
Did you have to work on other stuff to support yourself?
No, luckily I had made just enough cash, money, in order to pay enough of the rent. And because I was a professional actor, I was on unemployment. So I had 25 weeks of salary and 25 weeks of minimum unemployment payments. And that was just enough to eke out a living.
And was there any point where you just said, "Damn, I'm good. I can really do this."
No. Here's what I thought. And we actually talked about this, all of us young, you know, Turks that were out doing it at the same time. I said, "Look, we are as good as 50% of the people." Let's go back. This is what we said. We said, "We are better than 50% of the people in any audition. Just better." That's a level of cockiness that goes mm-hmm. on. They're fine. They're good. We're better. I am just as good as 40% of the people. Just as good. I can't touch the remaining 10% because they're geniuses. And they just do stuff. They're on another astral plane. So the odds...
Were there people who you remember from that time who were in that category who went on to become...
Everybody who had a job that, you know, that I didn't have. Because I didn't view myself as being in competition with the likes of them, because they had the jobs and they didn't even have to audition. It was like an odds process. Mm-hmm. The odds are better if you think you're better than 50%. That's confidence. The odds are still kind of in your favor if you think you're as good as the 40%. So timing ended up being everything. They need a guy my age with my voice and my hair and my eyes and my build. If they need that, I've got better than 40% odds.
And this was all auditions for stage roles.
Stage roles. I never could get I auditioned for one Maxwell House coffee commercial, but I didn't know what the process was. So they kept saying, "Slate it." I'm sorry? "Slate it." "What, slate? I don't understand. Slate what?" Say your name. I remember that coming. Oh, all right. I didn't get that job. No, this was.
And so you didn't. You weren't thinking that, you know, someday I'm going to be like a mega movie star.
God, no. I was hoping someday I could, you know, move into a better crappy apartment. That's all you're going for. No, I will say the thing I had in my pocket that was an advantage was complete obliviousness to any other possibility other than, gee, I hope I can get this job doing high button shoes at the Zanesville Playhouse over the summertime because it's going to pay close to $280 a week. I can make that. I can stretch that.
I want to ask you about another passion that you developed in your childhood. You just released a book, a great book of short stories called Uncommon Type. There is a story in that book called The Past is Important to Us, which is a great, great book about time travel. But it struck me, just thinking about your career and your story, that the past is important to you, that you are very focused on history. And, you know, you obviously you're very focused on the history of World War II, of the 60s. What attracted you to that? When did you start down that road?
When I started reading for pleasure, I don't know if it's proper to say this, but I had a very vivid imagination in all other respects of school pursuit. I was in the theater. I was quote unquote an actor. That is a lot of making things up that have to be rooted somehow in a concrete reality. So I read nonfiction because it really happened. Even if it was books like Leon Uris, who wrote like Armageddon or Mila 18 or Exodus Trinity, you know, or Arthur Haley, who wrote about hotels and airports and car manufacturing. But I read a lot of biographies and autobiographies because that was better than anything that you could possibly make up. I lived in a makeup in a fiction world, a make-believe world. And so I was not profoundly moved by an awful lot of novels unless they were set in some brand of concrete reality. Mm-hmm. And that's always been my interest in reading. I still read about World War II for pleasure and the space program. And there's a couple of really great books that came out of that are in then there about the 1939 World's Fair.
Yes, you describe it in extraordinary detail. There.
Yeah, you can get some good maps of what was there. But here, because I believe, and I have seen over and over again, is that vanity of vanity, all is vanity, nothing new is under the sun. Human behavior has demonstrated itself in a cyclical manner in the form of history. And when you're not involved in the nostalgia of a period, but in the human behavior of a period, it all folds right into what you and I are going through today.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that. Well, first of all, what about that World War II experience, generation? You know, I remember, we're about the same age. I remember when John F. Kennedy came to a little housing development where I grew up in New York to campaign in 1960. I was a little boy. And thinking back at it, this was a housing development for returning war veterans. Mm. And everyone there had just experienced this of everyone coming together to repel fascism, defend democracy. And there was a sense that anything was possible, mm-hmm. that you could overcome any obstacle. And I assume that's part of what attracts you to that generation.
There was a paradox that I was aware of from a very early age, is that there were two versions of the war. One was the movie war, the TV war, that ongoing mythic celebration of what the myth was with the right kind of music and the right kind of triumph and maps and stuff like that. But then there was the other one that was displayed by every single caregiver, every adult that was in my world, which was they talked about the war in very personal terms. Their lives, in fact, were divided up into three very specific acts. Before the war, when they talked about life before the war, their lives were simple. Their lives were also dangerous because They could get, you died of pneumonia before mm-hmm. World War II. You could have a tooth abscess that could kill you. There was a real difference between having 10 cents in the cookie jar and having 45 cents in the cookie jar, because that was an entire meal for a family of four, 45 cents. That was before the war. And when they say, well, you know, of course, that was before the war, because during the war was this huge cranial shift of their vision of the world, how big it was, how tight it was, and the forces that were out there that effectively altered their daily lives. If it wasn't literally leaving my dad left his, and his brother left their Willows, California, which is just a farm community that could be anywhere in America, and they went to the South Pacific. How does a farm kid get from the South Pacific? So geographically it altered, and from the moment the war began, really say 1939, to VE Day in 1945, there was no clue as to how long it was going to last. Their lives were in absolute stasis for, let's just say, 6 years.
Yeah.
And for to go through that for 6 years, that's an extraordinary acceptance of a brand of fate that you have no control over. You might die. You might never get back. It might be 1952. And guess what? You're still trying to take Saipan or liberate the Netherlands.
You capture a little of this in the story.
Yeah, there's
Christmas Eve
1953,
which really gives you a flavor of what you're talking
about. So seeing these grown-ups talk about it in ways, but because they're no longer, they weren't old folks talking about it. They were young folks talking about it. I always had this sense of those years as being a predominantly weighted time for them in which fate was, they had no control over their lives. They had to wait for him. And they talked about it. Well, of course, that was during the war when there were no answers to any questions. And then after the war, of course, it was like, we're here and we share that burden with so many other people. There's no reason to talk about it too much because everybody speaks the same common language.
And yet it did create a sense of community in that that was one common element that sort of brought everybody from all parts of the country together.
My dad had skills that he never would have had because of the war. Mm-hmm. He became a machinist, so he learned hydraulics and stuff like that. But he also had that grander world vision of places that where he go and sites that he had seen. I actually have an example of his VE mail. That he's writing a letter to his mom that says absolutely nothing other than, here I am, I'm not in the place I was before, I'm at a different place now, and some guys down there are talking and going to taking a rocket to the moon, but I don't think there's any Japs on the moon, so I don't think we'll go there anyway. Write to you next, and that's a letter. That type of both isolation at the same time of transportation that goes along, it affected them all. It affected the people that I was closest to.
Your work, not just your acting work, but your documentary work, some of the stories in this book sort of capture, it's almost the in sepia tones, that generation, that era. How does it compare to where we are today? You said earlier that there are lessons that you can draw from history.
Well, there are times, I think, when we have a national consciousness of permanence and other times of great transience, where we feel as though there are times of, hey, things are going good and all of our institutions are working according to the contract that we have with them and our popular culture is reflecting back to us a contentment and a sense of accomplishment. Certainly in the early 1960s, that was an awful lot of what was on TV and was in the movies and the nature of what we heard in all of popular culture. And right now, that I think the consensus is that those social contracts have all been broken, that we are often lied to, that we are often kept from knowledge. And then there's a reason to be outraged and there is a reason to be afraid. And there's a reason to look at outsiders as an upsetting of a status quo that really wasn't working for us in the first place. And a lot of that comes from signals that are sent to us by you know, I think organizations or institutions with an agenda. You know, I remember growing up, there was no such thing as littering. You just threw your garbage out. You know, I remember dumping garbage out of cars or, you know, what have you, because it wasn't until Lady Bird Johnson came along with an idea of keep America beautiful and stop littering. When everybody stopped littering, guess what? Our cities were a little bit cleaner, and so were the highways and whatnot. And I think we're back to littering. I think we're back to this concept of there's somebody else is responsible for this, not me. Somebody's job is to clean this up. Aspect of our tax dollars will clean the side of the highway or whatnot. I think that we are in a period where that brand of transience is scary. I mean, it's like Springsteen says, there's a darkness on the edge of town, you know. At the same time, you want to have an understanding of we take care of our own, but I think that we're more afraid right now, and I'm not sure that we know what we're afraid of.
Well, is part of it that we're being told by not just institutions but leaders to be afraid?
Well, yeah.
I mean, that's the elephant in the room. You know, we have a president who's got a very sharp edge to him. Does that contribute to that sense?
From a guy who is a, you know, lay historian who does it, here's Daniel Moynihan. Mm-hmm. Had this great saying, which was, you are entitled to your own opinion, but you are not entitled to your own facts. And that's not true anymore. Everybody has their own facts. And they cling to them. Sometimes they're insane conspiracy theories. But other times there are interpretations of people's motives. And other times it's like, 2 times 2 equals 4. There's not an accountant in the world that doesn't understand 2 times 2 does in fact equal 4. That's a fact. But as soon as you apply that to a measure of ozone in the air or a loss of ice in the polar ice, well, suddenly those facts, 2 times 2 doesn't equal 4 anymore. It means there's something else. You can question literally the math.
One of the institutions that people relied on when we were kids and for some time, was the news media to deliver those facts.
The fourth estate,
exactly.
And what are the four? Help me out here. There's there's government.
Yes.
There's the military. There's the religion, and then there's the press.
I grew up as a reporter. So I didn't care about the other three estates.
Oh, right, okay.
I was in the fourth estate.
Those estates that give order to our lives, that dictate our behaviors and keep us secure and establish the contracts we have both with our neighbors, with our town, and with our nation and the rest of the world.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files.
You just completed a film that's going to be released later this month called The Post, about the Washington Post and a particular episode in its storied history that went to the publication of the Pentagon Papers, secret papers that revealed what was going on inside the government and in many cases things that were hidden from the American people about judgments that were made. It was very, very controversial. Tell me about that. A big deal. Yes, we'll keep it there.
Yeah.
Tell me about that film.
Well,
Steven Spielberg.
I did. Steven Spielberg directed it, and it's really the story of how Kay Graham came to be Kay Graham, and it just happened to all
publisher of
the Washington Post, as well as Newsweek and television stations, and it all just happened to occur in the same week. And in order to be not just the figurehead, but also the owner and the publisher and the person who made the decisions, Katharine Graham had to decide whether or not to print stories about the Pentagon Papers.
Perhaps on the threat of imprisonment.
Right. The New York Times, who had run, who had already run these huge stories on it, was shut down, in fact. What is it, enjoined? What is the word?
Enjoined, yeah.
They were enjoined from publishing anymore by the government, by the Justice Department. They were shut down by agents of the President of the United States. Under the auspices, it's treasonous to publish this report that essentially just tells what happened since 1947. And I think the actual report was already 5 years old that it existed. And there wasn't secret plans in there. There wasn't battle plans. No one's lives were going to be lost
right.
By the publishing of the papers. It was just like, how did we get involved in Vietnam? It was asked to be prepared by the Secretary of Defense,
yes,
Robert McNamara. Because he says, we're in this mess. How did we get here? And it was just the story of how we ended up in Vietnam. The Washington Post found their own copies of enough of the pages in order to print their own stories on the Washington on the Pentagon Papers. But the threat was, if we do, are we committing treason? If we do, is the Justice Department going to lock us up because we're committing a crime based on what the government was saying? So the assault on the First Amendment was pretty basic. The assault was, I think you could almost take away the rest of the Constitution, but as long as you have that First Amendment,
yeah,
everything else could probably be defined by it. Freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, freedom of the press.
Yeah. The reason it's the First Amendment.
They came up with that, number one. The other stuff, they thought, we should think about that,
yes,
too. But those three things alone. And you had a president of the United States who is trying to shut down, literally trying to keep from publishing.
Richard Nixon
was. And that's what tyrants do. That's what crappy communist dictators do. And, you know, in the smaller countries on the other side, this is what banana republic dictators do. They shut down the newspapers. They keep them from printing, whatever stories it is. You know, I think it's interesting, David, because the questions, you know, as we go on and talk about this movie, it's all about fake news.
Right.
There's always been fake news. When they wrote the Constitution of the United States, there were daily newspapers that printed, you know, one side of the story without any regard to what the truth is. They have agendas, and they've always gone out and tried to tell only their side of what the story is, or it's sometimes outright lie. You know, Frank Sinatra fought against fake news, for crying out loud. Between gossip and the real other tools.
The tools of delivery, though, are more sophisticated now, more pervasive, and sometimes hard to track.
Well, it comes back down to what facts are you going to choose? If you read about, like, I just heard this thing on National Public Radio, the history of the Pizzagate story, the Comet, mm-hmm, Pizzagate story. It's madness.
A phony story trying to linking Hillary Clinton to a fictitious plot around sex trafficking.
Sex trafficking of young kids, pedophilia.
Based in a pizzeria in Washington. And it's some guy came up there believing that story. 2.5 million people read it. Some guy came up there with a gun.
And you go back to the news organizations that published or broadcast or talked about that story as though it was a fact, nearly resulted in a guy with a gun shooting up a bunch of people in a pizzeria in suburban Washington, D.C. That's an example of there was no fact there. So the idea that there, and you can go, look, who was the guy that ran the Chicago Tribune during World War II? Colonel McCormick. All right. You know, he was he printed his own versions of the facts, and
yeah,
that was in.
Well, that was a tradition in American journalism earlier. As I said, it's just the pervasiveness of it now, given the tools that are available with social media,
yeah,
the polarization on cable television and so on. But this movie, what is your hope? What is Steven Spielberg's hope?
I can't speak for Steven; he's the boss.
Yes. Well, I'll take yours.
Okay. The point that it takes is this, is that we are not the United States of America without the First Amendment. The freedom of speech means you get to say whatever you want to say outside of screaming fire in a crowded theater because people can die. That's not freedom of speech.
Right.
That's a crime. Freedom of assembly means you get to get together and hang out all you want to with whoever you want to. burning down a synagogue is not going to be allowed by that. But short of, you know, committing crimes and assaults, you get to assemble with any group you want to, any religion. Freedom of the press requires the same sort of absolute that we live in a country where we are able to publish, and anybody gets to say whatever they want to based on, I think, an individual contract that your organ has with society as a whole. If your contract is, we're going to not only get the truth, but we're going to double and triple check it, and we're going to go a far distance so that by the time you read what our findings are, you can have a huge amount of confidence that due diligence has been done, then you can decide whether or not it's important.
So it is a current issue, as you know.
Oh, well, it's because the president
has targeted news organizations that have printed things that he finds inconvenient,
unflattering. I believe he calls CNN fake news.
He did indeed, and the Washington Post.
And the Washington Post.
And other news organizations as well. How much does that concern you?
Well, as an American, it concerns me because it's monkeying around with our Constitution. It's relatively obvious, I think, is what is trying to go for. When you tear down these institutions to a level of say you can't believe anything that is in any of them, that raises the stock of those agenda-filled other institutions or whatnot, so that if you can't believe them, well, that means you get to believe some of the other stuff that is in these. And so what is happening is a dilution of the great, you know, they're throwing dirt and oil into a bucket of water, so it all becomes undrinkable after a while. And when conspiracy theorists ends up having the same amount of purchase as 27, reporters who are trying to get to the bottom of some records that exist somewhere, trying to determine what was said about Vietnam in 1956 and 1947 and 1963, well, then you're monkeying around with, I think, what the United States of America has been based upon, which is the great freedom to say what you want, assemble with who you want to, and read and be informed by those people that you want to turn to. Now, because we're not, you know, I think what the current administration is doing, I don't know that they're saying we have to shut them down so they don't publish anymore. That would
right. bring... Although the president did muse about pulling the license of NBC.
Which he does not have the power to.
There is some question about this antitrust suit.
There is that. Right, there is that. But yes. He's doing... What is happening is something that is more subtle and more insidious, and I think has more fingerprints from other governments in the past, mm-hmm. who have said, look, we can't shut them down because that will cause outrage, but we can denigrate them. We can call them names. We can tell people that those are not the facts. That's what he's saying.
You were criticized by some back at the beginning of the administration. I think I shared your view when you said, I'm not rooting for the president to fail.
Yeah.
And I thought back to at the beginning of the Obama administration, when I was in the administration, Rush Limbaugh said, I'm rooting for the president to fail. And I thought particularly at a time of national emergency, that was a terrible thing to say. And so I felt you owe the next president that same presumption. We're now 10 months in. Where do you think, how would you evaluate him?
Well, when we were back in the golden months of last October, you know, before the election, you know, people stick microphones in your face and mm-hmm. you think Donald Trump's going to get elected? And I said, I was one of the kids. No way. You don't elect a guy like that president of the United States. And I thought that all the way up. And I said something, you know, glib or flip. It's like, well, if that's going to happen, well, you know what? Then aliens are going to land on my front lawn and dinosaurs are going to wear capes. It was a silly answer for something that was impossible.
But Have you checked your lawn lately?
Well, if I had said instead, if that happens, neo-Nazis are going to hold torchlight parades in Charlottesville. And Pocahontas jokes will be said in front of the Navajo code talkers. That would have been just as hellacious an imagination, I think, as what we have.
Do you? What role do you think the entertainment industry played in putting Donald Trump in a position to become president of the United States?
Well, I think there's an us versus them kind of thing. I think a lot of times there's preaching to the choir that can come out of the Hollywood machinery. I think a lot of times stories are, you know, incredibly easy in order to show how good guys always win. But I think it's also part of the, you know, of the transcendence and a bit of the divide.
But let me just say, it's ironic to me because if not for The Apprentice and that vehicle that he had, he likely wouldn't be president of the United States today. And yet he also benefits from the disapprobation of the media, of the entertainment industry, I should say, Hollywood. You know, I watched the Emmys, and it was a real beatdown on Donald Trump. And my thought was, boy, this is probably helps him with his support.
Oh, it does. I think so, because at the end of the day, it's dogpiling. It's a degree of cheap shots. I will say, I think we have to admit this, though. Something profound came out of that election, and that is the rules were smashed. The rules no longer applied. A candidate could say outrageous things and not be penalized by it when it came down to the voting booth. And you can look at it as though some aspect of it, there was a national referendum that had enough of this ongoing political continuum that was always say the right things, always feed your base, always say just glittering generalities about anybody, because you don't want to offend. And that is translated, I think, to you don't want to tell the truth about what your opinions are. Here's a guy that you can't stop telling.
No one ever says, I wish he'd speak his mind.
Yeah. And what could come out of that? Well, what good could come out of that is that on whatever other side of the political divide, you'll start hearing people speak their minds. And unfortunately, it seems as though the only people who have done that so far are folks who are no longer running for office, mm-hmm. you know, who aren't part of that political combine that, you know, is a business in and of itself. Show business for ugly people.
You've talked about yourself as a lay historian here. You gave an answer in an interview recently about where you think we're going. And because there is a sense of unsettlement, of unease about where we are, in the sense that, well, we've crossed some Rubicon and we can't get back. And you quoted a book that Jay Winnick wrote called
April 1865.
Tell me about that. What was the point you were making? Because it seemed to be saying we should play the long game here, and that things will change again.
Yes. That what he puts forward is in regard to the question of slavery, for 15 years, 20 years, for most of the, up until 1860, the issue had become so pervasively divided that you were not allowed to speak to, if you were pro-slavery, you could not speak to the abolitionists. And if you were abolitionist, you couldn't have anything to do. Compromise was evil. Compromise, any sort of like voting process, any sort of discussion. Not that there was an awful lot of compromise you could have by keeping an entire race of people in bondage right. in order to make them work in the fields.
Right.
But there had been an uncompromising quality in which all of the political society had become binary. If you were a zero, there was no way you were a one. And if you were one, there was no way you were zero.
That sounds a little familiar.
And what came out? What came out of it? The 6 years of strife and more people were killed and more property was destroyed in the Civil War than all the other American involvements. That ends up being history. In all of the history that I've read, and all of the all the various things that I have tried to turn into nonfiction entertainment, you do come back to this other thing, which is the power of our immediate foundation. John, some of this began because when I was doing Philadelphia,
yes,
in Philadelphia. And so I'm walking around trying to get skinny because, you know, we're playing, right. somebody who is suffering from the great pandemic of our age. We visited the family. We visited Independence Hall, which is a great place to be. It's in the middle city. You go, the Liberty Bell, there it is. And you got the Supreme Court was in this room, and the House of Representatives were this room, and the Senate was up in this room. And the park ranger, the guy in the green uniform, the smoky bear hat, we're in the Senate chambers. We were the only ones there. It was a cold day, it was a weekday. And he said, and on that spot there, literally the physical spot, John Adams was sworn in as the second president of the United States. And for the first time in recorded human history, rule of a nation changed hands without to a non-relative without bloodshed or death. And my head exploded. Because I hadn't put it together that way. The great thing about our democracy is not us putting people into power. It's taking people out of power.
Yeah.
It's removing them. Egypt was a country that did not have a voice in who ran it any more than they had. They could stop the sun from rising. Well, they put in one group, and what they couldn't figure out is how to take the second step, was to remove the people that you want to take out of office because they had ended up a revolution. It was bad. But in America, we've done it again and again and again and again.
Yeah, which I think we take for granted.
We do, because even right now, it's like, there's an impeachment thing that's going around there.
Yeah, what do you think about that?
I'd say we have something better in store than that. We have an election coming up in less than a year now.
Yeah.
2018 is going to send a message that is going to reverberate far much more than any, Senate hearings or congressional stuff that's going to go by. That election in 2018 is going to prove one of two things. We will continue along and we will have the government we deserve, or a lot of people are going to show up and be motivated to vote in order to send out the waves and say, we are not satisfied with the way things are going right now. And the great, you go to any other nation in the world and you find out that in the United States, how much of our electorate turns out to vote in any given year?
Yeah.
40%?
Yeah. Well, yeah. More in a presidential race.
Race, but the real important. So if there is a turnout that says we're not satisfied with this, hey, baby, That's even better than going through the machinations.
Well, the other thing, and I've said this, is I think impeachment is a tool that should be used very carefully, because if it becomes commonplace to say, I dislike who's in office, so we're just going to impeach them, and I understand there are provocations, but there is a system in place. There are people who are investigating things. They will either lead to something or they won't. But if it becomes a casual tool, I think it's bad. It's bad for the country in the long run, and it's one more institution that will be abused. There are plenty of people who will debate both of us on this point.
If crimes have been committed, I get it. But we don't have to. It's a marathon. There's a longer faith that we can have, and everything goes in spurts, stops and starts. Sometimes you take one step forward, two steps back, but other times you take one step back and two steps forward, and that means you just keep moving forward a little bit.
I have to ask you about investigative reporting, because it's also shining a bright light in the corners of other corridors of power, and Hollywood has come under that scrutiny.
Mm-hmm.
You've seen some real giants of your industry, Harvey Weinstein, Kevin Spacey, and others, exposed is the wrong word, but who have been identified as sexual harassers, sexual abusers, or at least there are allegations of that.
Yeah,
allegations.
Call them
predators. Predators. Pervasive is that in the industry itself, and how complicit is everyone who has been around it all these years and not said anything about it?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, anybody who had like very specific knowledge of what was going on, that they'll have to answer questions about, you know, how complicit were they.
You saw a lot of stars, people you've acted with.
Rightly so.
But they came forward after these very brave women who were not prominent and who were not powerful told their stories to the New York Times, told them to Ronan Farrow Yorker.
Yeah. I think there's a number of reasons people go into this line of work that I'm in, essentially trying to come up with stories that people will pay to see. One is because it's less, just ridiculous amounts of fun. Two is, if you can make it stick, it can be a pretty good living, you know, and you get to travel the world and see interesting things. Some people do it for power. They just want to have a degree of power because that's the thing that gives them credence. It's something, you know, on one hand, it's a parking space with your name on it, and to take it to another extreme, it's the ability to beat up on underlings and say things like, so you want a job? You want to keep your job? Well, then you're going to have to fulfill these other demands I have on you that are of a sexual nature. That is pure harassment. It's, to the degree of assault. There are people like that, without a doubt, in Hollywood. I don't think it is as... It's not common core, but without a doubt, it's widespread. Because human nature comes down to, a lot of times those people in power have it for that very that ability, that access, in order to be a sexual predator.
Well, we've seen it in politics.
Well, it's everywhere.
We've seen it in business.
But you know, part of it also is goes like, look, we are, in a lot of ways, all of us are. We all left town and joined the circus, and the circus is glamorous in a lot of ways, and. There is camaraderie, and there is sex, and there's attraction, and there's boyfriends and girlfriends, and there's flirting, and that's always been part of it. There's onset affairs. There's no law against that.
But this goes far beyond.
This goes much farther beyond that because it ends up being a swaying of influence, and it becomes part of the marketplace. It becomes, when it is inherent into the workforce that you join, that you have to succumb to a degree of sexual harassment in order to keep your job. When that happens, the only thing you can say is, number one, I hope the victims come out and tell all sorts of stories, everything, tell the truth about what goes on, and that the repercussions land exactly as they should.
Well, were you surprised by some of these revelations?
I'm surprised by the overtness of it. Yeah, sure. Yes, absolutely. Am I surprised at some of the personalities involved? Not Harvey. Mm-hmm. You know, he had a way of doing business and, you know, a zero-sum game, negotiation stuff that would not make you surprised to have him be one of those kind of guys that does that in the workplace. Others are just like, well, there's a time and place for decorum and ethics, and you blew it. You know, there's that as well.
Do you think that there'll be scripts written about this, about these women who lived in terror, or will Hollywood protect itself from that?
Oh no, I think there's going to be quite a bit that's going to come out about it. And here's what's going to be an interesting test: is that going to be salacious, titillating, shocking, outrageous in order to draw viewers, or is it going to be human and realistic and authentic in its details in order to say what happened? In some ways, you can already see, you know, I'm sure there's already stories in development that are going to be based on the Harvey Weinstein or whatever. And is that going to be as, what's the word I'm looking for? Is that going to be as pure an examination of the theme as somebody else taking along and saying, well, let's fictionalize it and turn it into something so that we're not necessarily dealing with the specifics of any one person, but can get down to the specifics of what it really did to the human beings as well.
Do you think films like that, or let's talk about Philadelphia, which was a brave film in 1993, do you think they have the power to change things? Do you think Philadelphia hastened an understanding of age.
I think it did, both in what it accomplished and what it failed to accomplish. The throwing deep in the end zone on Philadelphia was that it was going to compete in the open marketplace. You could make a small movie for $400,000, and you could play in every film festival in the world, and only 62,000 people will see it. It will be a profoundly good movie to them. But when you're going out and you're going to compete in your local marketplace for a broad audience to come in and deal with something that is ripped right out of today's headlines, you have to do it in a manner that it's going to be somehow so approachable, authentic, and glamorous in order to attract an audience who simply wants to be entertained. If they become enlightened at the same time, good for you. But there's throughout all of American history, and which I have said, a gentleman's agreement with Gregory Peck in 1952 was about anti-Semitism that no one had ever touched before. The Best Years of Our Lives was about the emptiness that an entire generation faced when they came back from the war. And how in the world do they get on with that? You can go, The Grapes of Wrath. I mean, even though the ending was absolutely nothing like John Steinbeck wrote, it ended up being entering into the national consciousness and changing that consciousness, because you could not argue with the theme that it was examining. And Hollywood will do that all the time. It won't always land on it. It won't always make it happen. It might cop out periodically, but there's always going to be something coming down the pike that is meant to do it. The difference now is it might be on, you know, you might be on a streaming service as opposed to playing in your local cinema, because the superheroes are filling up all the cinemas.
Do you feel that when you look at roles, do you look for scripts? Are you excited by scripts that have that power that might? Or do you just look at them?
No, there's an awful lot of, like preaching to the choir. There's an awful lot of stories that people want to tell, and there's no surprises in it. And they're kind of like polemics, if I'm using the word polemic.
Yeah, really. Right. Uh-huh.
They're just kind of like treatises on something, and there's nothing new, there's nothing unique. And I find them kind of, a lot of times, they're void of the gray areas of human behavior. There's always oftentimes there's a specific bad guy and there's a specific good guy. And a lot of times there are no good guys or bad guys. They're just people who are poorly motivated or wrong. The things I look for is I was very lucky because when I went to Cleveland for the first year, I held a torch, or maybe it was a spear, during the entire scene of Hamlet's advice to the players. So every night I heard, "Speak the speech, I pray you," as I pronounce it, trippingly over the tongue. And inside that, he says, "Your job is to hold the mirror up to nature." It means you have to reflect back true human behavior, how we think, how we act, and the great paradoxes that are in all of our decisions. That is what I seek out in whatever it is I decide to go on and do. Even if you're, you know, searching for the Da Vinci Code, or you know, trying to determine who's an angel and who's
yeah. I think in your industry as well as in politics, where I worked for all those years, authenticity means so much. The ability to be true, as you suggest, is almost more important than anything else.
Right, and how true is your average photo op in politics, in which bales of hay have been realistically arranged in front of a barn on a riser with TV lights on it, and a collection of citizens are put in the back, and they're all in different dress, and they all have that, and someone comes on and talks about their intense desire to help the American family.
So I'm going to ask you, is that a leading question?
No.
I'm just saying
the stage.
No, you're right. No. But that doesn't mean that the people who ultimately succeed are the people who break through that and can make a real connection.
Well, right. It ends up being of what are you saying, and what is actually the authentic message that you're trying. What is the authentic change you're trying to bring? What is the enlightenment that you're trying for? What I do. What are we actually trying to tell any audience that comes in and watches a movie? You know, you want them to feel as though they got their money's worth. That's just business. That's the corporate side of it. But the artistic side of it is you want them to feel as though they were a part of something much larger than themselves and have a slightly new perspective on life as we know it. Whether they're seeing a movie movie that was takes place in, you know, the 1700s, or are you seeing a movie that took place in 1971?
Well, I will say that polling has gotten a bad rap. So I tell you this advisedly, but, you know, every poll I look at says Tom Hanks is the most trusted, Tom Hanks is the most beloved and popular actor. So,
isn't that right, guys? Give me a big huzzah.
So you must be
They're not allowed to say anything.
You've made that connection for a very long time, and that's an enormous accomplishment.
Well, I don't discount that. That says something. This is the way I take it, is that my countenance, if I should be so bold, matches my choices. You know, I think that's that. When you get to this point where you realize you're a bit of a commodity, and I realize I am, you know, from a business perspective, and the people who want me to do business with them, I understand I'm bringing into it the sum of everything I've ever done, everything I've ever said, yeah. Any reaction any audience has ever had. And
so probably don't screw it up now.
One, don't screw it up. But at the same time, you must stretch it somehow. Mm-hmm. Because otherwise, all you are is a bottle of Coca-Cola.
Right.
You need to provide some other brand of nourishment and healthiness. And so if those kind of very flattering polls that people say, they say, what better thing could you hear about yourself other than, hey, I trust you.
Yes.
That's about the highest praise you could get from anybody. And I got to tell you, there's times I've lied through my teeth, sometimes in promoting movies that even I knew weren't any good. But you can still get into that, an understanding of sometimes you take a shot, sometimes you don't. But, you know, countenance matching up with the quality of the choices you make, that's, outside of longevity, that's the only standard you can hold yourself to.
Well, Tom Hanks, it's pleasure to be with
you. I'm exhausted, David. Have I pontificated enough?
We're gonna give you a rest. No, it's really so good to be with you, and I appreciate
Oh, thank
your
you.
Time.
I enjoyed talking to you. No, I got to get my memorabilia back.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, brought to you by the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN Audio. The executive producer of The Axe Files is Emily Stanitz. The show is also produced by Miriam Annenberg, Samantha Neal, and Allison Siegel. And special thanks to our partners at CNN, including Courtney Coop, Megan Marcus, and Ashley Lusk. For more programming from the IOP, visit politics.uchicago.edu.